Did you know that most of the dishes in Tom Colicchio's craft restaurant are made and made in pots and pans? The braised short ribs, made and made in. The Rohan duck, made and made in. The heritage pork chop, you got it. Made and made in, which isn't surprising. Made In has been supplying top chefs and restaurants with high-end cookware for years for the simple reason that Made In makes exactly what demanding chefs are looking for. Their carbon steel cookware, for example, combines the best of cast iron and stainless clad, gets super hot, and is rugged enough for grills or an open flame. Best of all, Made In is sold online, so the professional-grade cookware is far more affordable than other high-end brands. If you want to take your cooking to the next level, remember what so many great dishes on menus all around the world have in common. They're made and made in. Save up to 25% this Memorial Day from the 18th until the 27th. Visit madeincookware.com. That's M-A-D-E-I-N cookware.com. Please check it out. Colombia gets worse, and who took the dog out? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, the sage of authenticity, Woods Jim Garrity, and the notorious M.B.D. Michael Brennan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National View podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Patriot Voices, Fast Growing Trees, and the Free the Economy podcast. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere. From Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing 5-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So, Jim Garrity, it seemed yesterday afternoon that Colombia was kind of optimistic that the protest was going to peter out with this extremely judicious policy of not resorting to any more arrests, but instead saying that students who persisted in the encampment would be suspended and handing out flyers explaining this in great detail and making some concessions on divestment, but not saying they were going to divest. And the numbers did seem to dwindle, but there's a hardcore that's saying, you know what, we're staying no matter what. And as it happens, they broke into a building last night. Some students were bravely trying to defend the building, but they broke windows, renamed it after a Palestinian child who died. So rather than de-escalating, Colombia's weakness has helped escalate the situation further. What do you make of it?
What do I make of it? Look, let's just say getting into Colombia was not a major headache that I had to struggle over. But if I were a Colombia grad, I would feel like the value of my education, or the perception of my education, is crashing. Because right now it does not look like a university is serious about the business of education, because they have effectively made most of the classes online only, or you know, online. They have effectively lost this building that the protesters now control it. There's
major,
no
it's a major building. It's not like an auxiliary gym or something.
Yeah,
major. They effectively understand it. Hamilton.
The front didn't hold. Yeah, and as of this recording, by the time people hear this, maybe it's changed. My understanding was the message they sent out to everybody was, do not come to campus unless you live here or your services are essential. So effectively, they're telling everybody, abandon the campus. Like, you know, you might. I know that the U.S. flag is no longer flying over the building. I know the Palestinian flag is now flying over the building. This is effectively a hostile takeover, and the administrators are willing to take it. We're not going to send the cops. Oh, no, that'd be controversial. I really am feeling like the consultants in Office Space, where you just want to sit down with the university president. And by the way, the Board of Regents, anybody seen them? Are they all relaxing in Cancun right now? You want to say to them and say, what is it you'd say you do here? Because I thought that they were getting paid quite generously to run a college and to run classes to educate students. And they've just abandoned that. They've just said, "Oh no, there's an angry crowd here. We can't do with it." And they've, you know, that, and they've made, you know, we've seen a similar trend on a whole bunch of other college campuses. You notice you're not seeing it in the red states. You notice you're not seeing it down in Florida, where, you know, Ben Sasse is running University of Florida. Ron DeSantis has made very clear there are certain states in which you don't see this kind of nonsense. In Texas, they're arresting people. In Georgia, There was that beautiful state trooper who I wanted not just give a medal. I was surprised he didn't get picked in the NFL draft, but that perfect form taking rusher, him down.
The Titans need that kind of edge rusher.
Right? You know, he doesn't allow the guy to step up into the pocket, just takes him down quickly. Look, there, you know, first of all, like every one of these universities has bent over backwards to give these students plenty of time and space to make their protests. And now they're like, okay, you got to get out of the quad. You got to let students go to campus, except at UCLA. You're allowed to keep the Jewish students out of the buildings there. It's an embarrassment. It's egregious.
Some Polytechnic Institute in California where the building's been barricaded for a week or something by Hamas protesters. So MBD, as we've talked repeatedly in this podcast now, if Columbia had just rearrested all the students or arrested a new student showing up at a new encampment after the arrest a week or two ago, this would have been done. It never would have gotten to this point. But they showed weakness. They showed they could be moved. And you know, the best policy, as Jim was alluding to, is like what Ben Sasse has done in Florida. Here are the rules. I'm setting them out. These are the lines. These are the red lines. They're not changing. We're sticking to them. And then when people violate them, you actually enforce them. But President Shafiq obviously is worried that any further arrest will lead to greater protests and a major faculty revolt. There have already been rumblings among the faculty. And I think any serious discipline as well, these suspensions, it's not clear they would actually mean anything. But if you expelled, you know, 12 ringleaders, that would get everyone's attention and probably put a stop to that, this stuff. But she doesn't want to do that either.
Yeah, it's a failure of nerve, and the results are predictable. I think expelling is the answer. I think for a huge number of these students, these arrests and the charges they're taking under them are not a significant deterrent, right? They're a badge of honor. The NYPD isn't you know, they're not throwing the book at these kids and, you know, making them pay huge fines or making them serve any significant time, even in a jail cell. And so I don't think that works at all. I think telling them you're being deprived now of the stage on which you have launched this protest and you're being evicted immediately and you will not have the status of a Columbia degree would do it. I don't think doing it to just 12 ringleaders would work now, though. I think they have to go quite a bit further.
Yes, like 100. Everyone involved last night. I mean, that would be totally justified, right?
Totally justified. And also anyone that they could identify. I mean, you know, I don't want to start a separate debate. I do think SAT rules in Florida are perfect for a public university and well stated. For a private university like Columbia, I mean, I'm still with Buckley. Administrators and disciplinary boards should not be in the business of determining whether go back to Poland was coolly expressing a deeply felt and sincere political opinion or was said in a harassing way. The content enough is menace and is totally incompatible with the mission of Columbia to getting students to embrace the truth in their life and to form an elite for a pluralistic Republican and Democratic polity like the United States. I have no problem with Columbia or other universities expelling these kids as a matter of orthodoxy. And they should do so. And they should be unashamed of doing so. I know people like Robbie George will argue that doing this would only harm conservatives, but frankly, I mean,
because it creates a precedent that you can be.
Yeah, I guess. But I mean, conservatives are barely even launching papers at these universities, let alone occupying them.
And this has been a couple steps beyond. In your hypothetical where you just expel someone for saying that thing about Poland, it's not clear, by the way, to me that was a student. It may have been said outside Columbia, right outside the gates. I'm not entirely sure, but they've gone well beyond any speech. And Charlie, so we've gone from the phase of these protests were mostly, according to their defenders, mostly not anti-Semitic. Now they're in mostly peaceful territory.
You know, one of the most frustrating things about this age is that we persist in a series of courses as a country that we know now don't work. I think we ought to forgive people in the past for making mistakes the first time. In the 1960s and 70s, there did seem to be a genuine consensus among economists that Keynesianism worked well, and that the ideas that came out of the monetarist camp were radical. Now, they were wrong, but they were understandably wrong. For those same people to push their ideas now takes chutzpah. And the same seems to be true of crime and protest and riots and so on. I can forgive the mistakes that were made before the broken windows era, but not now. We talked about Chicago before. We talked about San Francisco. We talked about New York. This is a choice. And what we're seeing at Columbia is a choice. It is not impossible to fix this. Look at the University of Florida, which did two things. The two things that you need to do to keep control. Number one, it explained clearly on paper in an official capacity what was protected and what was not. Ben Sasse at the University of Florida did not do what Michael is suggesting. I'm not getting into an argument over whether he should have, but he didn't. He said there's First Amendment protected activity, and then there is everything else. The second thing the University of Florida did was actually follow through. It showed no weakness. It said to those protesters, oh, you thought we were kidding? No, we weren't. You're not allowed to engage in this behavior, not this speech, this behavior. And it arrested them yesterday. Columbia has done neither of those things. The staff there have signaled agreement with many of the protesters rather than acting as adults and saying, here's what you may do and may not do neutrally. And they've issued threat after threat after threat, deadline after deadline, and then they've ignored them. This reminds me, if I may complete my meandering analogy, of academics in the late 1970s were saying, you know, the presidency, it's just too much for one man. It's impossible to impose on the federal government the sort of order and clarity that it once was. And so I guess that's just the country we live in. And then Ronald Reagan comes along and demonstrates that's nonsense. And if you said in 1989, well, the presidency, of course, is just too big and sprawling for what you were a fool. If you said it in 1975, maybe I can forgive you. We know how to do it. Florida has shown how to do it. So follow that model. Why don't they? Because they don't want to.
So speaking of Ronald Reagan, Jim, his opposition to the protests in California is one reason he became governor. He was a very stern law and order guy. I posted something in the corner, I think a compilation the Daily Caller had done of Reagan's videos discussing student disorder, and it's still stirring to this day. I mean, and some really harsh and strong stuff, which is a segue to the exit question to you first. How much are these student protests and how much will these student protests hurt Joe Biden in November? Not at all. It's kind of irrelevancy. Yeah, maybe a little bit, some, or a lot.
I'm going to say some. I do think one of the reasons you see a lot of coverage of protests on college campuses, and in particular Ivy League college campuses, is because a lot of people in the mainstream media went to these colleges. And so it strikes a chord with them. It's their home. It's, you know, it hits close to home, so to speak. I think to the average American, what's going on a college campus can often seem very far away and not really a big part of their life. On the other hand, I do kind of feel like these images add to this growing sense that the country is out of control. You throw this in with the high crime rates. You throw this in with the Soros-funded prosecutors who don't, you know, zero bail, all the other, you know, things that have gone on. This growing sense of chaos, homeless encampments in cities, this sudden sense that we can't enforce laws anymore and that the government will come down on you like a ton of bricks if you pray outside an abortion clinic. But the actual axe murderers, they'll tend to let everybody go free. So I think it'll be a difference on the margins. I think everybody's opinions of Trump and Biden are all pretty clear on this. But it will reaffirm, and it will also give a, I think, just a general sense that the job of the presidency and running the country is just beyond Biden at his advanced age.
MBD?
A little bit. I expect at some point Trump will come up with a kind of clever line linking that disorder to student debt forgiveness and other Biden follies. So a little bit, but he's not... Biden's function in the Democratic Party is to be not McGovern, right? Or to be,
go along, but not be, go along with McGovernism, but not be McGovern.
Right. Not be him, like to still fool you into thinking like, hey, this is a coalition about jobs and the working class between, Scranton and Akron and, slapping each other on the back on St. Patrick's Day parades, whatever, rather than, you know, the madness of the universities in 68. So he is a little bit of immunity from it for those who are lower information voters.
Charlie?
I think it will depend on how long it continues and whether it spills out into the politics that people watch. I don't think most people are paying attention to this or care that much, but I do think they will if it hits the DNC in Chicago, as it did in 68. If I were the key players within the Democratic Party right now, I would be doing everything within my power to try to prevent that. But of course, therein lies the paradox. The sort of people who are key players within the contemporary Democratic Party wouldn't think like that. They better hope it doesn't spill out.
I would say maybe the high end of a little bit, because I take MBD's point. Biden, people don't really directly associate Biden with this kind of stuff, but he has been mealy-mouthed about it. It does play into, as Jim said, a sense that things are out of control and does catch him in a version. It's a softer, less dire version of the same trap that the president of Colombia is in. You know, Biden needs to distance himself from these people, but he can't be too excoriatingly tough because he's got to be worried about that youth vote. Now, they're kind of different polls show different things on the youth vote, but there's some polls that are just unbelievably bad for Joe Biden. Literally unbelievable. It's hard to know why young people are so down on him. And some of it might be that a lot of young people are Latinos, and a lot of Latinos are now down on Biden because of the basic things like the economy and the border being out of control. So I'm high end a little bit with that. Let's go to a message from our first sponsor, Patriot Voices. Here's a simple thought. Parents matter. After all, who knows what's better for children, their parents or bureaucrats? Do you know what's best for your child? Or do bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. have your child's best interests at heart? The answer is obvious. Parents matter. Right now, Congress is advancing a bill called the Kids Online Safety Act. This bill would strip parents of their decision-making authority if bureaucrats at the Federal Trade Commission decide that a Christian video or homeschooling site is dangerous or unscientific. Your family won't be able to access that material on the internet. Kids will be banned from seeing content online that the government deems dangerous. But the government's definition of what poses a threat to your child very likely is not your definition. If you believe parents matter, join Patriot Voices in opposing this takeover of parents' authority. Go to patriotvoices.com for more information and to take action. Again, that's patriotvoices.com because parents matter. So MBD, I think the one thing you want to do if you're a potential vice presidential aspirant is not have a campaign memoir come out where you're having to go on Twitter and explain, well, actually, the state's law says it's okay to shoot your dog in these certain circumstances. So Kristi Noem, to demonstrate what an earthy woman is, she is, what a tough woman she is, including her memoir, the story of her shooting and throwing into a pit an unruly puppy and also a mean goat. And the backlash has pretty much been across the board. I guess some MAGA folks have been defending her, and you know, you never know quite what to make of this sort of speculative coverage, but there's been some coverage that people around Trump are like, ah, you know, we don't like this.
Yeah. So it's not unknown. It is not unknown for some country people to shoot a dog that is a chicken killer, right? That was the story, is that she took this dog out hunting. It was useless in the hunt. Then on the way back, it killed a neighbor's chickens. And then as a kind of matter of making amends and, expelling her own anger at the puppy, she took it, in her own words, to a gravel pit and shot it. It's hard to think of a story more likely to alienate the suburban female voters that, a female vice presidential pick is supposed to help Trump with. I mean, it would be much more relatable to those voters if she said, like, this dog didn't do well in the hunt, and then I took him to a canine aromatherapist, you know, or something. Right. I'm dead serious. I mean, Americans are very, most Americans that don't live in the country, and many that do live in the country, are very sentimental about their dogs.
Yeah. I mean, abortion is more popular than dog killing.
Yeah, and very accommodating of bad puppy behavior. Like, I mean, so the whole thing, you know, it is an older rural value that she kind of was embodying in this story, but it's not one that that works. I mean, and it's I cannot believe that, you know, she didn't give this as a draft for someone to read for, you know, just the politics of it, and that person didn't suggest.
Really, I'm sure they must have, right? And they just misread it.
But I mean, like, yeah, I just would have advised her not to include this story and not, yeah,
obviously,
not to brag about it. I mean, it's just like I said, I do know some country people for whom this would not shock them, and it would reflect her membership in their, you know, kind of imagined moral community, right? Like, this is, animals are tools on a farm, as well as the product. But
yeah,
you know, this is just not gonna work.
Yeah. So Charlie, it's one of these things where it doesn't matter really ultimately, right, whether she did this or not. But sometimes it's the stories that don't matter that end up hurting you the most or mattering the most. And this is just one of them, because it's colorful, it's memorable, and it's kind of funny.
It's just perfectly emblematic of the escalation in our politics. We went from Obama eating a dog to Kristi Noem shooting one. I don't know what the next presidential aspirant will do. Drop a nuclear weapon on a pound.
I forgot the Obama eating dog news cycles. Those are great.
You beat me to the joke.
Mitt Romney looks pretty good just putting his dog on the roof of the car, which Gail Collins wrote about 37 times in 2012.
I forgot about that too.
37 times. That was for her the big question of the election. I expect she read the news about Kristi Noem and fainted. It's horrible. And I say that as someone who grew up in the country and does understand the different way of looking at it. But there's just no other reaction I can force in myself. I am actually allergic to dogs. We have a dog, but I can't spend too much time with our dog because I'm pretty allergic to her.
I think that's just your excuse, Charlie, for not spending time with
your dog. No, it's not. And you know, the sad part of this, Rich, is I grew up with cats and I developed an allergy to them in my early 20s, which really did upset me because I loved cats. But now when I go to my parents' house, they just can't sit on me, which I spent a lot of time as a kid with the cat just sitting on my lap. I can't do it now. I'm more allergic to cats than to dogs even. But, you know, I do, whether it's rational or not, draw the same distinction between, you know, cats and dogs and other animals that we're quite happy killing, like cows, that most other people do. I've perhaps been trained into that. That's not true of every culture. But it's horrible. I mean, this was a puppy. We like puppies. It's very hard to recover from. You can try and argue your way out of it, as you say. And I, in an abstract sense, will probably comprehend some of the arguments being made. But once you are that person who shot a puppy in a gravel pit, that's the detail that, by the way, kills it. Because it makes it sound like a crime's going down, that they met at a gravel pit at midnight and shot the dog.
Yeah, the gravel pit makes it so much better, the story.
Yeah, was Michael Vick there? I don't know. This is just... one of those things you can't recover from.
Lots of prisons used to have where they would do the executions was a stone yard. So it's like literally, there's this kind of penal context to it. It's just like really like you've been sentenced justly. And that is so alien.
Rich, I had about 1,000 dog jokes, and I want to thank you for going to a third. So everybody can get to those jokes first. I mean, you do look at this and you're like, oh my God, what kind of idiot would tell her this is a good thing to put in your autobiography? Who would be advising her thinking this is the sort of thing that makes her look good? You'd have to be a moron like Corey Lewandowski to do now all of a sudden everything makes sense now. Also, if you ever have a chance to visit Christy Noem's house, she invites you over. She makes fried chicken. She offers you some, take one piece. Don't take two. See what happens when somebody eats too much chicken around her. Take you out back. Look, I don't think Christy Noem was ever a terribly likely selection as Trump's running mate. I don't think anyone was worried about the key swing state of South Dakota or the all those electoral college votes there. But the idea was, okay, so, you know, any woman governor in the Republican Party is a possibility on the list. I think, honest to goodness, like I alluded to the alleged special relationship she had with Corey Lewandowski, there are some morons in this world who think that Trump loves toughness. And, Leo, we do know also that Trump believes that his previous vice president wasn't willing to do the dirty work and wasn't willing to do what needed to be done. And saying, I'm willing to shoot a puppy. By the way, shooting a puppy was like the all-purpose metaphor for like the worst imaginable scandal. And here is the governor of South Dakota. Oh, yeah, I did that. You know, is basically saying, Trump, I will do the dirtiest deeds you need me to do. There is no depth that I will not stoop to if you select me to be your running mate. And I think there's in some, you know, genuinely psychopathic mindset that makes sense as a day to appeal to Trump. I don't think Donald Trump is always saying somebody begged like a dog, but he's not a.
I heard someone saying that Trump doesn't like dogs.
It's conceivable, but like this is not Canine Soleimani where he wants somebody to execute dogs or something.
I mean, I don't particularly like lizards, but I don't go around shooting them.
Although I believe that is legal in Florida. Anyway, the general sense is that. I don't think there's ever a likely selection. I think this takes her off the list. And I do think it is there's something revealing about this, about the degree to which like this desire, like I'm fascinated by the sheer number of people in Republican politics who want to be Trump's running mate, considering how things turned out for Mike Pence, right? Yeah. Like they really seem to be saying like, well, what are the odds that there are two angry mobs calling to hang the vice president simultaneously? That won't happen two times in a row. Trump is famously respectful of the people he works with.
It's like Churchill when he was in the Boer War, and the train he was on was attacked, and he needed to get the conductor to start moving the train again. The conductor was wounded. He's like, it's impossible to be shot twice in the same day. So you're fine. You're fine now. So let's do a little Veep Stakes by way of an exit question. Let's start with you, Jim Garrity. Percentage odds of do each of these individually, percentage odds from 0 to 100 that they will be selected as Trump's Veep nominee: Kristi Noem, Tim Scott, J.D. Vance, Doug Burgum. Kristi Noem.
Okay. 0. That's easy.
Tim Scott.
20 to 25%. Do I have to give precise ones, or do I give you ranges?
We'll do a little range. That's fine.
All right.
Feeling generous today, J.D. Vance.
I'm going to say 10 to 15. I don't think Trump needs Ohio. I think he's got it. I think that I think he likes Vance, but I just don't think that he's probably more effective for Trump's agenda in the Senate than he is as a vice president. So 10 to 15.
Burgum?
He's a name that's Burgum, apparently flavor of the month. And that's me. I would have, up until this week, I would have said like 5%. But it sounds like Trump kind of likes it. I mean, you talk about somebody who would like suddenly balance out that ticket, and probably the most Pence-like figure. So
how balanced in what sense? Like normal and boring?
Normal and boring. That's how you see this balanced, Rich.
Yeah. So how is Burgum balance Trump?
Sane and insane. Buttoned down and frothing at the mouth. Understands what the Constitution is, wants to terminate the Constitution. That's pretty balanced, you know. Whatever your perspective is, you can find it on the Republican ticket. So Burgum maybe is up to like 15-20% now, based on that report.
All right. I haven't talked to our friend, the Dominator, Dominic Pino, about this, but he's a big Burgum guy. So maybe it's a way to get the Pino vote, to secure the Pino vote.
The
NBD,
crucial Pino vote.
Noem, Scott, Vance, Burgum.
I'm going to be a Noem 0. And I think Jim's exactly right about on Vance, 10 to 15% on the theory that it's more, he's more valuable to Trump in this, as his hammer in the Senate, you know, where he needs allies, like even Lindsey Graham sometimes is an ally of Trump. Let's see, who else?
Scott?
Scott, I'm going to say 15%, a little lower than Jim, and I'm going to say Burgum 30%. I think that's actually,
whoa.
I think that's just an idea that, I think it could take on a life of its own, and I do think it's because he balances it out exactly as Jim said, as a more buttoned down, like reliable, steady, you don't need to fire breathers on the ticket. And he's someone who's could be president, and he's endorsed Trump early and campaigned for him. I think he's the type of guy, like Trump thinks like a guy who casts roles. All right. He wanted to cast the roles around him. That's why he picked all those generals.
You think he's going to think Burgum looks like a vice president?
Exactly. And like the kind of guy that, you know, although I don't think.
Because he's okay looking, but not, you know, fantastically good looking. So he's just sort of like a good second man kind of.
Good second man.
Wow. And this is where we were drifting, I would have made this the Burgum Mania edition of the editors at the top. You know, this ep has surprised even me. So Charlie, Noem, Scott, Vance, Burgum.
Noem, I think, has been knocked down to 0 by this. Scott, I would say, is at about 20-25%. I still think he's an option. Not sure he's the best option, but he is an option. Vance, well, if you remember when we discussed Veeps last time, my view was that Trump needed to pick someone who was not the same as Trump, who balanced out his liabilities. I think Trump either knows that or will be persuaded of that, as he was in 2016. So I think the chance of Vance is pretty low, maybe 5-10%, probably too high. Burgum. So I like Burgum for the same reason Dominic Pino likes Burgum, because he's exactly the sort of person who should be president. He's quiet, responsible, thoughtful, and a limited government guy. I'm not sure that the tastes of Charles Cook and Dominic Pino are shared abroad the land in quite the numbers you would need to make that work, but perhaps I'm wrong. Perhaps he'll fill the Pence role and reassure the public if they even know who he is. I'm just slightly
for them, it'll barely dominate a news cycle.
Yeah, I'm slightly taken aback by the reports, though, which do seem to be real, that Trump likes the guy. So I'll give him 25%.
Whoa. Wow.
Well, because if Trump is really thinking about it, then he's really thinking about it, irrespective of what I think.
And it's getting close. It's getting close to time for him to settle down on one.
So there is a person very high up in Trump world who told our reporter Audrey Fahlberg that they love Burgum. They just love Burgum. They've loved working with him since he got out of the race, and he's become a surrogate. So
He was loyal early in 2016 too. He endorsed Trump very early in that primary. So,
and he can deliver the swing state of North Dakota.
So I'm going to go zero on Noam, like everyone else. 20% Scott, 20% Vance. I would not sleep on Vance at all. And you know, ideologically, I prefer Scott to Vance, but I'm just not sure Scott is going to be deft enough to pull it off. Both the outside game with all the pressure that comes with being the Veep choice, and the inside game, if Trump's elected, actually tiptoeing around the raindrops and maintaining a good relationship with him in difficult circumstances. Vance, I think, would be deft enough. I think Vance is he tips more likely if Trump thinks he's a step ahead in this race and doesn't need a lot of Veep help. I'd also put Burgum in that category. I just don't think he's going to help. I don't think most people will think of it as balancing Trump. They'll just think of it as that we don't know anything about this Veep and he's fine. You know, we don't need this Veep choice. We don't need to think about him. So maybe I'll put him at a 10%. But if Trump feels though he doesn't need help from his Veep pick, if I were him, I'd do Vance rather than Burgum, because you know it's making Burgum the heir, and he's been nice to you. He's endorsed you early, but he's not one of you. He's not a MAGA guy, whereas Vance now is. So with that, let's go to our second sponsor this episode: Fast Growing Trees. This summer, you could spend thousands of dollars on planes, hotels, and tourist traps, or you can spend less money on a beautiful garden that will give you years of pleasure with FastGrowingTrees.com. FastGrowingTrees.com has thousands of easy-to-grow plants, shrubs, and tree varieties expertly curated for your unique climate and needs. From Meyer lemons to evergreens to shade trees and everything in between, no more waiting in long lines and hauling heavy plants around. With FastGrowingTrees.com, you order online and your plants arrive at your door in just a few days. No green thumb, no problem. FastGrowingTrees plant experts are just a Zoom chat or phone call away and always available and eager to help. They can even walk you through your entire garden to help solve problems you're having with plants and trees. Plus, Fast Growing Trees plant experts have specialized degrees and training to help troubleshoot from root to leaf. It's like telehealth for your plants. We at the Lowry household ordered a jasmine bush a while ago, and it's just amazing, you know. And this nice clean box shows up at your door just a couple days later with this plant ready to go. And none other than the incomparable Sarah Schutte has also had a wonderful experience with Fast Growing Trees. Am I right, Sarah?
Yes, you're right, Rich. I have two lemon trees, which hopefully I may get something from this year. I just ordered a blueberry bush and two strawberry plants. Oh, and as the ad said, you're right. They do give you lots of help. The help that you get is fantastic. I reached out to Fast Growing Trees with some questions and they got back very quickly to me. So I've been very happy so far.
Awesome. And so your plan is to use these fruits in baking, I imagine?
Yes, that's my goal.
Lemon tarts or something?
Oh my gosh. If I could make a lemon meringue pie from my own trees, that would be the highlight.
And with Fast Growing Trees 30-day live and thrive guarantee, you know everything will look great fresh out of the box. Join almost 2 million happy Fast Growing Trees customers. Go to fastgrowingtrees.com/editors right now and get 15% off your entire order. 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com/editor. So, Charlie, we got the ongoing Trump trial being covered pretty much wall to wall on cable news as we record here Tuesday morning. The news was a $9,000 fine imposed on the former president by the judge in the case for 9 violations of the gag order. The gag order is a major point of contention in this trial. What do you make of it?
Well, a few things. First, there are legitimate circumstances in which to deploy gag orders. But one has to be very careful when one is dealing with a political candidate. And I know that sounds to some as if I'm special pleading on Donald Trump's behalf. I don't think I am. I think I'm acknowledging a trade-off. Certainly, if a Democratic politician were being gagged while running for office, we would hear all manner of pie-ins to our democracy. This question seems to have been under-interrogated and under-discussed. It's difficult because whenever you're talking about criminal justice, especially the hard cases, you're dealing with people who you might not like or who might not be pleasant or who might not be virtuous. And it is, of course, true that Trump accepts almost no limits on his own desires. But I think if you zoom out, what I see is a frivolous case brought late for political reasons, attended by appeals to politics, not law, and now decorated with a gag order that should give people pause. And I just find the whole thing sordid.
So, Jim, it is sordid. Look, and Trump can say harsh and untrue things about people, which is not doesn't sit naturally in a judicial proceeding. But this is a politically, at the very least, a politically fraught case, even if you don't think it's a entirely politicized case targeted against Donald Trump because he's a presidential candidate, which I happen to believe. And Donald Trump is not the average defendant. He's a political candidate who is worried naturally about the political effects of this trial. So the idea that he just shouldn't be able to comment on it or make the case that it's wrong and illegitimate when that's part of the case he's making for himself or the political defense he's making of himself is pretty outrageous in my view.
For all of our listeners who think that I am some sort of knee-jerk Trump basher, don't blink or don't close your ears for the next few minutes. So one of Trump's complaints, you all probably see the headline, you know, Trump attacks judge's daughter. You think, oh my God, what a maniac. What's wrong with this man? You're probably picturing
this poor 12-year-old girl. Yeah,
you're picturing a girl with pigtails or something. Like, oh my goodness, how could, well, first of all, not only is the judge's daughter an adult, right? The judge's daughter is Lauren Merchant. She served as president of Authentic Campaigns, a firm that does digital campaign work like online fundraising, mobile messaging, and web design. They work with Democratic political candidates, including some of Trump's most outspoken opponents. This is not from some crazy right-wing source. Oh, it's from that crazy right-wing outlet known as CNN. And
yeah, so the one thing we know that is if you hire authentic campaigns to work for you, you're not probably not running an authentic campaign.
Well, what's more, Lauren Merchant's LinkedIn said she was the director of digital persuasion for now Vice President Kamala Harris's 2020 presidential campaign. So you ever hear the phrase, you know, purer than Caesar's wife, and that if you want to go into something that is inherently controversial, that is inherently politically charged, ideally, everybody involved would have no paper trail associating them with the opposition party if you're going to indict a prominent Republican. Well, here you have the judge who, oh, by the way, so it was on the LinkedIn, the Authentic Campaigns has simply scrubbed references to her on its site. No, it's like it goes away. Well, if they don't see references to her on the site, it's not like there's any issue. Look, if you're going to prosecute Donald Trump, I would really prefer if the judge's daughter had not worked for Kamala Harris in 2020. I don't think that's an unreasonable objection. New York City's got a lot of judges. There's got to be some judge out there who does not have a family connection to working for the vice president. The idea, like, should Trump be gagged over this? No, this is a fair gripe. Now, you know, does this mean the judge is automatically going to be biased in everything they do? No, but I think, considering the stakes, I think if you were the New York City court system, you'd really like to have a judge with no familial tie to the Biden administration. That doesn't seem like a crazy request there. So in this case, I think Trump has a perfectly legitimate gripe. It would be better if some other judge was on this case. And what percentage of judges in New York City have daughters who worked for vice? Like no more than 20%, right? 30 or 40?
I don't know. It is pretty high percentage though. And the other issue is they're all MSNBC viewers, right? You can just they watch Rachel Maddow and they have her attitude towards things, and especially to Trump, which is just one reason it's going to be so hard for Trump to get a fair shake. MBD and in this case and others, and Andy McCarthy wrote a column the other day on how the judge and how he's ruling in this case seems to be just teeing up a Trump conviction.
Yeah, we're stepping on future editor's pick. It's naked lawfare, and this this case is ridiculous. It's a ridiculous farce to try to portray this case as one in which Donald Trump is being convicted or tried and potentially convicted for election interference. I mean, the whole idea is preposterous. It's just, basically using a courtroom as a prop to publicize a dirty but not illegal deed that Trump did, and then trying to spin up a legal meaning for it that it doesn't carry. And as I said in the previous episode, I don't know how much more of this we can take without becoming something like this, like without becoming a kind of banana republic. I mean, this is just not, this is not good constitutional hygiene. I don't want to be put in a position of saying, oh, Trump's a victim, but like, got to call a spade here. This prosecution is a discredit to our system and a discredit to our politics in 2024.
Yeah, so he's always been squirrely, brag about what the second crime is. So he needs a second crime because the bookkeeping matter is a misdemeanor. So to bootstrap it up into a felony, you need to say it was in commission of another crime. And apparently, the theory now is that the other crime is a violation of New York election law, which is also a misdemeanor. So he's making, adding up two misdemeanors into 34 felonies. But Charlie, big exit question to you, bouncing off part of what MBD was saying at the end there. This case and the others show that U.S. politics is trending in a third world direction, as many of the critics say, yes or no?
Well, no. Well, yes.
Yeah, I guess it depends. I mean, direction the, does a lot of work there, right?
And trending.
Yeah.
And this is redolent of third world behavior, but it is so far from it. And our system stands up. Take January 6th as a good example of it. What Trump said and tried to do was third worldish.
Yep.
His fans said and tried to do and did was third worldish. But it was hit with a first world hammer called the Constitution that was never, ever in danger, that is still extremely strong. So, yes, I suppose trending, but the idea we are a banana republic, we are a third world country, we're in profound danger of getting there, I just don't think it's true.
So, Charlie Wood, going back to January 6th, so I agree totally that the mob had zero power to affect anything at the end of the day. Even if they occupied, you know, like they are at California Polytechnic, you know, the Capitol for a week and barricaded, they just would have met somewhere else. But what if Pence had given way? Would that have been a threat to the Constitution?
Well, it would have made the threat far worse, yes. Mm-hmm. I've said to you, I think Trump should have been impeached for trying to rewrite the 12th Amendment and the Electoral Count Act. That was his crime, not the crowd. The crowd was incidental. The crowd was an offshoot of that.
Yeah.
What Trump did was appalling and disqualifying. Pence would have disqualified himself and been appalling had he played ball. The system would have still stood up. But yeah, I think when you have the vice president and the president, there's a scale, isn't there? You start with the president, then you need people to go along.
Yeah.
The point at which you would be a third world country or something approximating one is if there was any chance exactly of the states acquiescing. At that point, the system's dead.
Jim Garrity, trending towards third world, yes or no?
Yeah, in the sense that Trump brings out the worst in his enemies, and they're willing to not just, you know, cut corners. As I said, you know, you got to be purer than Caesar's wife. You got to avoid any, even the appearance of political conflict. And nobody seems to worry about that anymore.
So what happened? What would your answer be, Jim, if Trump's is jailed before the election?
I mean, that would be a conviction by the jury, right?
Yeah,
not just convicted. It would just be like this: we didn't like the way this judge ruled on this. We didn't like this, you know, on some detail of the trial. You know, the argument would be: did Trump get a fair trial? And he would have opportunities to appeal. I think it's safe to say he's got the very finest lawyers who are still willing to work for him. And you know, like some of that's on him. Some of that's he creates his own problems. And he and his defense attorneys had their chance to try to get any one of those 12 jurors to hold out and create a hung jury, or to get a defense. He had every chance to mount his defense, and maybe if he, you know, stopped falling asleep and all there like that, it does not set Donald Trump is a nightmare client, which probably does not increase the odds of him beating this. I know the argument, oh, you know, there's no way Trump can get a fair trial in Manhattan or something like that. We'll see. You know, like if that's the case, then argue that this was an unfair trial. Not just like we didn't like with the
Jim, can I?
Yeah, go ahead.
Very slightly disagree with you on that.
You could more
of
than
course
slightly.
of course, one key component here is the process. The fact that these charges have been brought formally, the fact that there will be a jury, that there is a trial, and so on. I agree with you. That is a bulwark within our system, but the fact that Donald Trump has done things that put himself in this position in a way that many other political candidates would not have, and the fact that we have a proper system of justice, does not completely obviate the problem here any more than it does in Colorado with the Masterpiece Cake Shop guy, who also gets to take advantage of the American system of government, due process, legislative government, and so on, but who is nevertheless being abused. And I just want to draw that distinction because, yeah, there's a lot in the way, and I'm extremely bullish on the prospects for the American system. But that doesn't mean this isn't third worldish harassment at root, right?
Yeah, and if we're talking sort of matters of degree, you know, third world-ish MBD, it seems to me if Trump's in jail, that would emphasize, put us a few ticks more into third world territory. And there's this guy named Sugarman, who's a law professor somewhere, who's written a couple times about the Bragg case in the New York Times, and seems a very reasonable, fair-minded guy, you know, because he agrees with me, but not just because that. He's written thoughtful pieces on why the Bragg case is wrong, and he wrote another one the other day. And at the end, he concluded, but there's a jury, and Trump can appeal. But that doesn't really fix the problem, because resources and time are being taken from Trump. So even if, you know, in 2025, he's convicted, and then in 2025, he appeals, and it's all thrown out, the damage is already done, right? I mean, the time and the money, if nothing else, and then the potential political damage, I don't think it would be huge in this particular case, but still they get to say he's a convicted felon. So it's really, you know, the process is the punishment. The trial is a part of the punishment here.
Yeah, I mean, it's let's see. I'll give an entertaining answer here. I'll hang everything on the ish. It's becoming characteristic of what I think of as maybe our occasional peer group in the world, the gargantuan democracies, Brazil and India. Like we typically, like in the first world, we're saying
second world, not third world.
In we typically say like first world, like the Europe and the United States are comparable. But like Europe now is a system where, I think we should say definitively it's not really democratic anymore. Brussels just throws away governments in Italy like they're paper towels after they wipe their face with them. They bribe publics in Poland to elect new governments. You know, Europe is lost. It's kind of fake. I hope they enjoy their retirement under our security aegis and then maybe a quiet death. We're the last thing going, but we are becoming a little bit more like Brazil and India.
So it's definitely trending that way or ish, you know, both January 6th and these lawfare attacks against Trump. But one, we have a first world architecture, as Charlie points out, with the Constitution, and still basically first world norms and attitudes towards politics. With that, let's hear from our third sponsor. This episode, our friends from the Competitive Enterprise Institute have all new episodes of their breakout Free the Economy podcast. If you're not already listening to the show, Free the Economy is a weekly podcast hosted by Richard Morrison that explores opportunities for financial success and self-fulfillment in a world with less government control. Each episode, host Richard Morrison offers news and analysis on the economy and fascinating conversations with experts on topics ranging from the future of artificial intelligence to the perils of a central bank digital currency. Think of the podcast as big ideas meets real world application in ways that make our economy better, healthier, and wealthier. So check out Free the Economy wherever you listen to podcasts or visit CEI.org/freetheeconomy. That's CEI.org/freetheeconomy. So let's hit a few other things before we go. Jim Garrity, you've come across National Review in the AP history curriculum down in Authenticity Woods.
Yes, I got a text from my older teenager earlier this morning. And you get a text from your kid during the school day. Oh, God, what happened? You know, well, honest to goodness, my older one was very thrilled to find out National Review is listed in the history book. I got a screenshot of like half the page, so I can't really give you a word for word description. But it says, as far as I can tell, since the 1950s, William F. Buckley, the found National Review, and Milton Friedman, the Nobel Chicago, has been the most prominent conservative government which we fought relentlessly. Buckley policy. For his part, Friedman became a national capitalism and freedom, 1960. Anyway, so you get the idea that it sounds good. This says the fragments that I get there. So I'm glad that it is part of it. It belonged to that. I have already sent the message, the argument. I think it was George Will said in one of our videos that
Without National Review and William F. Buckley, you don't get the presidential campaign of Ronald Reagan. Without the presidential campaign of Ronald Reagan, you don't get the presidency of Ronald Reagan. Without the presidency of Ronald Reagan, you don't get the end of the Cold War. Therefore, National Review is the single most influential magazine in the history of humanity.
NBD, you've been spending some time at Little League games.
Well, actually, a little bit better than that. I took my sons to their first Little League practice and game, and there was a little parade, and it was quite a proud dad moment. I haven't done, I'm not like a rigorous sports dad, and I'm never going to be one, I don't think. And I just played catch with my older son in the backyard a little bit, got him a little familiar with the glove, took a few practice swings with like a foam bat. Well, whatever it is, they enrolled him in a league where they start them out and they're not even on the tee, just pitching to them, the coaches. And first pitch, my son, took some instructions. He looked awkward taking the instruction. But the first pitch came and he just ripped it through the infield. Third single.
All
went
right.
3 for 3.
Single.
Went 3 for 3.
All right. Love it.
2 runs, still kind of figuring out the infield fly rule. Otherwise, it would have been 3 for 3 with 3 runs. But, he's on his way. Could not have gone any better to instill his love of the game and to make his dad proud.
Awesome. Congrats. Charlie?
I started watching the Apple TV show Franklin, having watched the Apple TV show Manhunt. I think it's good. It was very slow, the first episode. And the one thing that I'm wondering is whether Michael Douglas is just too famous to play Franklin in a way that Paul Giamatti was not too famous to play John Adams. Because still, despite the makeup and the affect, every time I look at him, I think, that's Michael Douglas. Whereas, of course, the other characters don't have that effect on me. But I shall report back as to whether or not it maintains its quality or if Michael Douglas remains too famous to play Franklin.
So I'm out in California for a National Review Institute regional seminar. So I was on a plane out here yesterday, and there was something wrong with my video monitor. I couldn't change the channel or anything, and I couldn't turn it off. And it was playing Mean Girls the musical. So now I've watched this movie as much as probably any other movie in my life. I'm looking now; it's only a 6-hour flight, and this movie is nearly two hours long. But I felt as though I saw it actually 4 or 5 times, and I wasn't listening. And it's a musical, but I wasn't listening. But you kind of get the gist. But I tried everything I could. I was trying to prop up the brochures and whatnot, so I couldn't see the screen because I was actually trying to work. So I absorbed a lot of Mean Girls yesterday. With that, it's time for editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick is the aforementioned Amy McCarthy piece. Let me pull it up here again. How Judge Merchan is Orchestrating Trump's Conviction. I think he just gets right at the key issues and the obfuscations and the hanky-panky going on in this trial. It's very thorough, and it helped me shape up my thoughts on this.
Jim Garrity.
We've had a lot of good stuff written about the Columbia University protests and the effective takeover of the campus. I think my favorite, though, has been Luther Ray Abel, a corner post the other day, just simply called Columbia Capitulates. And it, foresaw that the endless negotiations were just a matter of another form of surrender, foresaw that this was going, that, even taking over the buildings would not lead the Columbia University administrators to recognize their role as the authority and to take action to regain control of the campus. As he points out, the rabble is getting more comfortable by the day. So good job, Luther.
Yeah, I thought that might have been a little too harsh when I first read it, but as you say, has proven prescient. Charlie?
I'm going to pick your piece, Rich. No, Columbia isn't complicit in genocide. I hinted at this yesterday.
Yeah, when I saw your headline, I was like, oh no, Charlie's already written it.
Well, I got that very small part of my piece from you, so I'm glad you wrote it up. But it's unclear to me why students are supposed to protest all the time to start with. But the actual protest that they're engaged in here is bizarre, that Columbia University is guilty of genocide. I mean, you have to play absurd logical games to get there. No court would convict.
So my pick is Jeff Blahar's post on Kristi Noem and the puppy, which is just totally excoriating and hilarious from beginning to end. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National U podcast, and a rebroadcast, retransmission, or count this game without the express written permission of National U Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the aforementioned Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to Patriot Voices, Fast Growing Trees, and the Free the Economy podcast. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.